I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. We have a quorum now, and I know that Representative Coonan has been pouring over the minutes in great detail, so I don't know if Representative Coonan, are you ready for a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, I move to approve the minutes.
Minutes are moved. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion, the minutes are approved. Members, I don't know if this is appropriate, but I was picking up over there that possibly Representative Lanning has some announcements for us. I saw the pictures coming out of the pocket, so Representative Lanning, did you want to tell us what's up in your world?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to introduce my newest grandson.
All right.
Parker Morris Christensen, born last Wednesday, so very happy.
Congratulations.
And I'd be happy to show pictures.
Madam Chair.
Representative Simpson.
Not to be outdone by Representative Lanning, but on my cell phone, I have a picture of my granddaughter who was born this weekend, and her name is Caitlin Marie, and she came into the fine state of New York about 4:30 on Saturday morning. So,
thank you, Representative. That's pretty exciting, members. I think we'll know. Oh, a grandchild in the office.
Yeah.
Representative Carlson has his grandchild in the office. Well, that's great. Well, Representative Lanning and Representative Simpson and anyone else, including Representative Carlson, if you ever want to bring that grandchild here, we'll take a minute when they're visiting to introduce them. And members, just one item of business before we start. I do want to refer a number of bills down to the division. They are listed on the agenda. Not on the agenda, just on my agenda. They are House File 3, House File 50, 61, 96, 134, 135, 142, 148, and 157. A number of those folks are members of the Tax Committee, and we will get that information to you if that was one of your bills. Representative Earhart's looking at me, and yes, your House File 148 was referred to the division. So members, we will look forward to Representative Marquardt starting to hear all those property tax bills. And now we're going to go ahead and finish the House briefing with Mr. Michael. And Mr. Michael, maybe you can tell me, what else are we doing today? I can't recall now. Were we trying to get through your presentation, and then we're going to do property taxes tomorrow with the rest of the division, and then on Wednesday we're going to have the governor's budget before us, I think, if that's correct. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Today the plan is to complete the rest of the state tax briefing. Then Cynthia and Kathy, the fiscal analysts, are going to talk for a time about the difference, or about revenue estimates, fiscal notes, and spreadsheets, and the distinctions. Those of you who are new to the Tax Committee and have served on other finance divisions or familiar with fiscal notes, we deal with a couple of different items here, so you need to sort of get the terminology and the methods right, so that might be useful. And after that, then I'm going to do a brief presentation on sort of things to think about in dealing with non-revenue raising uses for the tax system, which is not sort of an orientation overview briefing that we've done before, but the chair asked us to put it together as sort of a way for the committee to have a structure to think about those kinds of issues that frequently come before the tax committee. So that's the basic plan. Before taking up where I'd left off, I'd like to just briefly respond to a question that Representative Carlson had raised the last time we met with regard to sales tax effective rates. I believe in your packet you should have a memo from Pat Dalton and me that looks like this, and on the back page of it there's a table. Maybe that didn't make it in. Maybe we'll wait to do that. Now the table,
Mr.
table
Michael,
looks like this.
I think it was in our packet the last time we met. Is that right?
Yeah. No.
No?
Okay.
So
maybe we'll
have it? Okay, I apologize. We don't have it in members' packets.
Maybe what we should do is have it copied.
Okay.
And then I'll go through the rest of the presentation, and we'll talk about it at the end.
Okay. That sounds good.
If I can take the staple off, if I want to let somebody more confident than me do that. Let's see. We left off talking about the motor vehicle license tax, and the next, again, these taxes are ordered by the amount of revenue they're projected to raise in fiscal year 2007. And so the next largest set of taxes is actually a couple of taxes together, and that's the cigarette and tobacco products tax. And they're really, I guess this could be considered to be two taxes and a couple fees, or depending upon what definition of tax you use, a tax, two taxes. The basic cigarette excise tax is fairly simple to understand. It's a per unit tax that's levied based on the number of cigarettes. It's 48 cents per pack of 20. Most cigarettes are sold in packs of 20. I think there are occasionally packs of 10 that are sold. Because this is just a set dollar amount per unit, obviously as the price of cigarettes changes, they go up or down, the tax doesn't change. And as inflation erodes the value of the dollar, this tax also doesn't change. So that's something that's a little, it's similar to the gas tax in that way, and later when we talk about the alcoholic beverage excise taxes, it's similar in that way. Now the tobacco products tax, and this is the tax that's imposed on things like cigars, pipe tobaccos, snuff, chewing tobacco, and that sort of thing, is a very different kind of a tax in that it's based on 35% of the wholesale price of those products. And so as the price changes, the yield of that tax changes, unlike the cigarette tax. In the 2005 session, as I'm sure you all remembered, one of the part of the budget deal was to impose a health impact fee on cigarettes, which is 75 cents per pack, and a 35% of wholesale price tax on tobacco products. So that essentially doubled the tax on tobacco products. So that tax is 70% of the wholesale price. And on cigarettes, the combined tax is $1.23. So all of those taxes together raised $451 million. And that includes the health impact fee, and there's also, as you notice on the bottom of this slide, there's another more minor fee on what are called non-settlement cigarettes. These are cigarettes that are produced by companies that were not part of the state's settlement with the big four tobacco manufacturers. So that's sort of the sum of the generic product. That doesn't raise very much. It's $3.5 million. That has, along with the health impact fee, was the subject of litigation. The U.S. Supreme Court just this fall finally ended that by denying cert in the case that was challenging that non-settlement cigarette fee. Most of this money from the cigarette and tobacco tax goes to the general fund. There's $31 million of dedicated funding for health research. And that dedication now, after the 05 session, is just done by dollar amount. So that $31 million is sort of always a deduction off the top of the revenues. The health impact fee goes into a special fund and is released after there's a estimate that the state's smoking-related costs at least equal that amount. The next largest state tax, again, by size of revenue, is the Minnesota Care Provider taxes. These are a group of taxes that are imposed on health care providers. And basically, it's the tax base is the gross revenues of those providers. So it applies to physicians, hospitals, dentists, psychotherapists, and all these variety of different health care providers. The tax rate's 2% of their gross revenues. There are limited exemptions. The revenue that those providers receive from Medicare is exempt, and from the federal employees' health benefits program, those are also exempt. That latter exemption resulted from a court case that challenged the ability of the estate to tax those programs. All of this money goes into the Health Care Access Fund, which is used to pay for the Minnesota Care Program. That fund also has part of the insurance premium tax that's imposed on a couple of types of insurance companies, which we'll get to in a little bit. The revenue is projected to be about $400 million for next fiscal year.
Excuse me, Mr. Michael, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me which of the providers can pass through the Medicare tax? I think the dentist can, because I get that as an extra, but how about the other providers, the hospitals and the...
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, by law, all of the providers are permitted to pass the tax through to the ultimate purchaser, or in the case where it's an insurance company or an entity like that, they're, you know, permitted to add it to their bill. Now, I believe you're getting into sort of a legally complex area here, and it's handled in somewhat different ways, because sometimes there are contracts that are negotiated between the providers and the insurers, and in those negotiations, they take into account the provider tax, and so it doesn't show up necessarily on the statements that you get, but you can be sure that it's been negotiated into the contract.
Well, I get the impression, Madam Chair, that the doctors don't know if they can pass that through, but maybe it's because they've already made the agreement with the providers. They are really up in arms. Every time I see a doctor, I walk across the street, so I'm not on the same side of the street with them in my district. So.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair,
have you had to cross the street and Indiana too?
I'm not sure about that. But there are always issues about sort of market power and other factors that may affect the ability of, you know, maybe you can legally pass the tax through, but if the person you're negotiating sets the price of your basic service and is able to do that, that might not be
okay.
Much salve.
Well, I'm going to tell him that, Madam Chair, the next time that I'll stay on the same side of the street.
Representative Liebling. He probably has the same problem in Rochester, is my guess.
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, except, well, they don't blame me for it yet. But I had a question, though, related to that, and that is are there other examples of taxes in Minnesota, or indeed in the country that you know of, that are like this in the sense that we're taxing a particular occupation or particular category of revenue earners in order to provide a service that's a general service throughout the state? And, you know, in particular, I think of attorneys, of which I am one. You know, they're always talking about how do we provide services for poor people, and whether attorneys should be perhaps even required to do pro bono service to provide that. And that hasn't happened so far. Thank goodness they're not required. You know, I can imagine the outcry if, say, we taxed attorneys' revenues in order to provide for legal services for poor people. Or if, say, we taxed plumbers' revenues to provide for people who can't afford plumbing. I mean, are there other examples of this besides in the medical area?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm not familiar with, certainly not in Minnesota, we don't have examples of specific industry or occupational taxes, other than, for example, the next tax on the agenda, which is the insurance premium tax, which is sort of a separate business and has always traditionally been taxed separately. There are a handful of other states that have some similar analogs to the Minnesota Care Tax, and I think they're typically used to, you know, fund health care. I don't know that there's much more you can say about it. The one thing, I guess the one observation is that And of course, this would be true of attorneys too, but the healthcare industry generally is fairly lightly taxed, and I think that may have been some of the motivation for it. So, for example, purchases of most kinds of medical and healthcare products are not subject to the sales tax, and of course, the services are not subject to the sales tax. So I suppose you might be able to make a policy case that, well, although they're paying a 2% provider tax, that's probably a better deal than if they were subject, like most other industries, to the general sales tax. But of course, almost no sales taxes in the whole country tax healthcare services. And when you hear about base expansions, that's not something that's typically talked about. So that might be sort of more of an academic point than a practical point in responding to that. There, in terms of the number of other states that have a similar tax, I don't know the answer to that, and it's kind of interesting because I had that same question this morning from an analyst who's working on that, and when that work is done, maybe we'll know exactly how many of those taxes are out there. Turning to the insurance premium tax, this is a little bit of an unusual tax in that, again, it's one of the few instances where we single out one industry and impose a separate tax, and the insurance industry does not pay the corporate franchise tax. So so insurance companies, unlike other kinds of corporations, aren't subject to the general corporate income tax. Instead, all of them are subject to this gross premiums tax, which basically is like a sales tax at a basic 2% rate. Now, there's some kinds of insurance companies that have lower rates. There's a 1% rate that applies to town and farmers mutuals and to mutuals that have $5 million in assets or less. And then there's a 1.26% rate that applies to small mutuals, which are defined as mutuals that have $1.6 billion in assets back in 1989, so they may not really be small in most people's minds. There's a 1% rate that applies to HMOs and nonprofit health service corporations. That's the legal name for the Blues. And fraternal benefit societies like Thrivent, for example, are not subject to this tax. The 1% tax on HMOs and Blue Cross, et cetera, goes to the Healthcare Access Fund to help finance Minnesota Care. One of the things that makes the insurance premium tax an interesting tax is that Congress, years ago, back in the 1940s, enacted a law that said basically the Commerce Clause restrictions do not apply to the insurance premium tax, and there's a long history that I won't go into here, but essentially what that allows is states to discriminate against out-of-state insurance companies, and almost all states do that through this retaliatory tax. And when you try to think about insurance premiums tax policy, the retaliatory tax is a very important consideration. Because almost all states, including Minnesota, have a provision like this. And basically what it says is, if you tax our companies, defined as companies domiciled in our state, more heavily than we do, we're going to tax your companies on the same basis. And that's not very important if you're a state that doesn't have many insurance companies. So if you're in New Mexico, let's say, that doesn't have many home-based insurance companies, it's probably not very important. But when you're a state like Minnesota or Iowa or Connecticut or whatever that has a bunch of important domiciled insurance companies that sell their product in other states, if you raise our tax on all companies, that has the effect of raising the tax that our companies pay, our companies being defined as Minnesota-based companies, that they must charge and pay on their products when they sell them in other states that would otherwise have lower taxes but for the tax increase. And it works conversely the other way, that if we reduce our tax, then our in-state insurance companies, to the extent that there are other states out there where they're selling their policies that have lower tax rates, they will realize a tax reduction not just on the business that they sell in Minnesota, but the business that they sell in these other states that have lower than 2% premium taxes or whatever. And so anytime you want to change the insurance premium tax, that retaliatory tax becomes an important consideration, whether you're raising or lowering the tax. And some of you who were around when we recently reduced the tax on life insurance will probably remember that. This tax raises a little less than $400 million for fiscal 07, and as I indicated before, some of this goes to the Minnesota Care Fund, and the tax on fire insurance and on auto insurance is partially dedicated to help pay for the police and fire pensions. The next tax I want to talk about is the mortgage registry tax. This is a tax that's imposed on essentially mortgage debt. So it's loans that are secured by a mortgage on real property in Minnesota. It's at a 2.3% rate. It's collected by the lender and paid to the county when the mortgage is registered or recorded. The counties are allowed to retain 3% of this tax to offset their collection costs. Revenues are about $130 million for FY07. That's net of the local share. Sort of a companion tax that relates to the deed. This is the instrument that actually changes the ownership of property, is the deed transfer tax. The rate on this is 0.33% of whatever is paid for the property. And again, it's the responsibility of the person who transfers the property to pay the tax, but of course the purchaser is the one that wants to ensure that it gets paid, because if you have to pay it in order to register the deed to prove ownership. And again, the counties are allowed to retain 3% of this to offset their collection costs. The revenues are a little bit lower than the mortgage registry tax. Mortgage registry tax, as you can imagine, those revenues are a little bit volatile, because refinancing activity triggers additional payments of the tax. So when interest rates drop significantly, you'll see an increase in mortgage registry tax rates. Now, the deed transfer tax is somewhat more stable because the refinancing does not affect it. Next tax that I would like to talk about is the estate tax. This is a tax that is in somewhat of a flux a little bit because of the recent changes in federal law. It's based on federal law concepts. For 15 years, Minnesota was what was called a pickup tax state. And under that tax regime, the amount of our estate tax was simply equal to the amount of the credit that was allowed under the federal estate tax. And this was a dollar-for-dollar credit. So the fact that we imposed this tax really imposed no net burden on estates or their heirs. If we had reduced our tax, essentially what would have happened is the federal tax would have gone up by a dollar-for-dollar amount. As you can imagine, every one of the states had a tax like that, because essentially all of the benefit of it came at the expense of the federal treasury. Well, in the 2001 federal tax law, they repealed that federal credit over a three-year period. When that was done, the Minnesota legislature, because we were in some budget difficulties, decided to maintain our tax equal to what the old federal credit was. Otherwise, we'd have, you know, essentially the whole tax would have gone away, and that's what happened in most states, as a matter of fact. So now we have really what should be thought of as a standalone tax, because it is not. Although it's equal to the old federal credit, it's really a true tax. It doesn't reduce your federal tax dollar for dollar. The amount of the tax that's paid is deductible in computing the federal estate tax, though, so that does provide an offset in the amount of tax, the ultimate net tax burden. Basically, the tax is based on the market value of the estate at the time of death. Transfers to the surviving spouse are exempt. Charitable bequests are exempt. And there's an exemption amount of $1 million. because of the fact that there's a deduction for transfers to surviving spouses, a married couple with appropriate planning can effectively exempt up to $2 million of their estate. Tax rates range from 6.4% to 16%.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, just a quick question. Do we have all of the generation skipping rules and all of the federal have become pretty involved over the last 10, 15 years? Do we have all that built into ours? Or?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory, Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, we do not. We essentially just follow the federal estate tax. And to the extent that there's, you know, the federal government has a separate generation skipping tax, which Minnesota does not. There are a few states that have done that. This tax raises about $100 million per year. The revenues are very volatile. It obviously depends upon who dies, and this is a, you know, sort of a moderate-sized estate, so they can range quite a bit. And just on the slide there, you can see that in 06, we collected $216 million in revenue, and in 01, we collected $54 million in revenue, and that's just sort of a quirk of, you know, what estates were taxable in those years, and that 1 year when there were $216 million were collected, I believe one estate paid over $110 million in tax. How we compare with other states, as I indicated, most states were like Minnesota before the 2001 federal tax law, and most of those states allowed their taxes to expire with the federal credit. As of 2007, there are 26 states that have no tax at all, and there are four more that are phasing out their taxes between now and 2010. Of our surrounding states, North Dakota and South Dakota do not have taxes. Nebraska and Iowa do. Wisconsin's tax is scheduled to go away in 2008. One of the big issues with the estate tax always is the question, does it cause the affluent people that are subject to the tax, it's only about 2% of the states that are subject to it, to change their domicile. Many of these people obviously have two homes. And states like Florida, Texas, Nevada do not have taxes. So if they can arrange their affairs to be non-residents, they can avoid the tax. Alcoholic beverage excise taxes. These, like the motor fuels tax and the cigarette tax, are a dollar amount per unit of beverage, so they do not go up with inflation. On the slide, you can see that the tax rates displayed. The tax on distilled spirits is quite a bit higher than that on wine and beer if it was based on alcohol content, for example, rather than just, you know, a dollar amount based on the beverage type. Estimated it'll raise $73 million in fiscal 2007. Now, when Pat went through the sales tax, she noted that there's this special gross receipts tax on retail sales of alcoholic beverages that, I forget, it raises about $60 million, and that really, it's useful to think about that as sort of a special alcohol tax as well, and keep that in mind in thinking about these taxes. Finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about the JobZ program that was enacted by the 2003 legislature. These zones are all required by law to be located outside the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And qualified businesses receive a broad set of tax incentives in those zones. In order to qualify, a business has to enter an agreement under the business subsidy law with the zone administrator, which is usually a city or a county that applied for the zone designation. The businesses that enter into those agreements that, you know, pledge creation of jobs and certain amounts of activity qualify for an individual income tax exemption on their business income, their rents, and their capital gains. There's a corporate franchise tax exemption if they're a C corporation, and that's done using an apportionment formula. The purchase, all of their business purchases are exempt from the sales tax, including their building materials. And also their property is exempt from the property tax. That doesn't apply to the land, and it also doesn't apply to school district bond and operating referendum levies that were approved before the Job Z zone was designated. Finally, there's a refundable jobs credit for jobs that pay over $30,000 a year, and the credit applies to the amount of compensation in excess of that threshold. There were 10 zones that were designated with, I think, 325 zones, about 29,000 acres. As of the end of December, DEED had reported that they had entered into, that local zone administrators had entered into 281 deals with businesses in Job Z, and there's also one egg processing zone. That's the end of the state taxes presentation. I think probably everybody has now copies of this memo that Pat and I wrote to respond to Representative Carlson's question about sales tax effective rates. Just to take a minute on that, if you look at the fourth column from the left, it's the one that's got a heading that says adjusted revenues as a percent of personal income. This essentially is the dollar amount paid in sales tax by state divided by the personal income of the state. So if you want to think about an effective rate as how much of your income you pay in sales tax, this is a pretty good measure of that, you know, taking into account sort of the limitations that are involved with personal income. For example, capital gain income is not in personal income under the way those concepts are measured by the federal government. As you can see, Minnesota has a 2.81% rate, which is gives it a 10%, a rank of 10. It might be interesting to look at the two columns over from that, which is the breadth of base. And these numbers are based on data that were compiled by an economics professor at the University of Indiana that makes adjustments to the other states to try to account for some of the quirks in their taxes relative to how census tabulates numbers. But anyway, that measure is sort of a good way to sort of benchmark Minnesota as to how much we tax relative to other states. As you can see, our breadth of base, according to this calculation, is about 43%. Some other states are, you know, quite a bit higher than us. And a few are lower, but on that we sort of rank right in the middle at the 23rd. And that reflects in part the fact that Minnesota has sort of below average or slightly below average tax base, but a higher rate. So that's how we get the 10th rank on revenues as a percent of personal income, whereas the breadth of our base is a 23rd rank. And finally, on the right two columns, you can see the sort of the statutory state rate. And again, these are just state numbers. There are many states that have many more local sales taxes than we do. And so rankings for total state and local sales taxes, we tend to be lower, and other states tend to be higher because of that factor.
Thank you. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, just going back to the Job Z for a second, and I really can't remember even the name of the Ohio case, but there was a case on preference and tax treatment. I'm sure you know it probably by memory and everything, and it's been winding through for about a couple years. there was some talk that some people thought it might end up, if you expanded the concept, affecting the Job Z. Is there any, I haven't followed that case for at least a year and a half or so. Is there any possible expansion that way, or?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I think what you're referring to is the Kuno versus Daimler Chrysler case, which was in the U.S. Supreme Court, in which the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit held that a tax credit that Ohio provided to Daimler Chrysler was unconstitutional because it discriminated against out-of-state businesses. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided that case and held that the plaintiffs did not have standing to challenge it in federal court. And so they sent it back, and I believe it's probably been, I don't know this, but I think the plaintiffs were planning to refile it in state court, which is what they had done originally. And the defendants, the state of Ohio and the taxpayer, had removed it to federal court, and that sort of ended up meaning the taxpayer, or that the plaintiffs did not have standing. There was also a Job Z case filed in Minnesota based on a taxpayer challenge, and that ended up with the same resolution with the district court holding that the plaintiffs who filed as taxpayers did not have standing to challenge the Job Z provisions. And I believe that the time for appealing that has probably expired now, although I'm not absolutely sure. I think it was decided in October. So both of the cases were resolved on the grounds that taxpayers did not have standing to challenge these tax incentives. And I think the sort of, it's unclear. I had dinner once with the plaintiff's lawyer in the Kuno case, and I think this was before the case was decided, and I think it's fair to say that he was very nervous about the standing, but he was fairly confident that under Ohio law they would have standing. So it's possible that that case will wend its way back, although who knows what the result will be in the Ohio courts. But in general, I think the lesson in this, and particularly in Minnesota, that it's mainly the affected businesses that will have standing to challenge, and that some taxpayer who feels that this is not a good use of the government's resources is going to have a very hard time finding standing to challenge the allowance of these tax incentives.
Thank you.
With that, I'll let the fiscal analysts talk about the revenue notes and so forth. Let me.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. Michelle, please walk us through the portion you have for us. And I just want to ask, were we going to get to local fiscal notes today, or as part of it today? Okay.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, in your packets you should have three pieces of information. One is on letterhead, the Fiscal Analysis Department on Revenue Estimates is the first page. The second one is an example of a revenue estimate. It is for Senate File 2689. And then the third one is a spreadsheet. At the top it says 2005 for special session. We'll be referring to these documents during the presentation. And I'm going to go through this presentation pretty quickly. There are four items we want to talk about today. Briefly today, revenue estimates, fiscal notes, local impact notes, and our spreadsheets. I will be covering the first item, revenue estimates. This is a document. Revenue estimates are documents that we will see throughout the session. They are prepared by the Department of Revenue, by their tax research department. And what these documents do are provide an estimate of how the bill language will change tax collections or tax expenditures. The handout that you have before you says that these documents provide information of how the bill language will change tax collections and tax expenditures for property tax relief programs. It's really these documents will show changes to revenues and expenditures for any changes to the tax structure. Also in these revenue estimate documents, the department has a description of the methodology used for making their estimates, and they include comments on interpretation of statutory language. I know most of you know and have seen these from your past experience, but it's something for new members that we really want to help familiarize yourself with. Another important point about the department revenue estimates is they're based on static analysis. There's no credit for general stimulus to the economy in these estimates. And some of these estimates do make changes to elasticity. Mr. Michael talked about cigarette taxes and health impact fees. And I believe in the 2005 session there were some adjustments to elasticities in these revenue estimates. And generally, in these estimates, the department assumes 100% compliance. One other point about these revenue estimates is that they do not, this is kind of the key point here, they do not include information about administrative costs to the agencies. That information is in another document, and we'll get into that later. How to request revenue estimates, we ask that if you could, to request a revenue estimate through myself or through Catherine Schill. We kind of are the liaisons with these revenue estimates. We, when a bill is being introduced and if there is a hearing, oftentimes, historically, a revenue estimate is needed for the committee hearing. And the department will prepare a revenue estimate or on bills that have a hearing. They give priority to those bills. They will prepare a revenue estimate on bills that do not have a hearing, but they are given lesser priority.
Ms. Templin?
Yes.
If I could just stop you there, and I really want to underline that point to committee members. Members who served on the committee who've been on the committee for a while know that often these revenue estimates arrive at the committee the day of or the day before, and they're often very important to very big bills. And I just really want to encourage members to work with Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill to get these underway. I mean, obviously, if you get a bill in, you request a hearing, you get a hearing, it's going to get here. But we really hope that members will use our own House fiscal staff to get these pieces of information to the committee as soon as possible. I know sometimes members are very frustrated when they don't actually know the revenue estimate to their very own bill until they walk into committee. So to the extent you can work in-house, people tend to think they need to talk to the Department of Revenue, but they can start with Ms. Schill and Ms. Templin right here, and we'll be able to expedite the work on your bills much quicker if we do it that way. Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair and members, the other point about revenue estimates, we throughout the session are tracking these revenue estimates, and a lot of time there are changes to or amendments to House files, and we will keep track of those changes as the new revenue estimates come in. And the last week of session, those revenue estimates are important pieces of information that we need to have and track on the spreadsheet. So it's important that we be on top of that, we have the information about revenue estimates on House files for this committee throughout the session. So since you can't, and you do remember, if you need a revenue estimate, please go through us. That would make the session work very smoothly. Where to find the revenue estimates? The Department of Revenue will send a completed revenue estimate to the chief author, and we are also given a copy of that revenue estimate. completed revenue estimates on bills that have been introduced are available on the department's website. And they are listed on the department website under revenue analysis, and they're not searchable by author. They're searchable by House file. There's also Senate file bills there. They have revenue estimates going back to 1999. And if you have any questions about the revenue estimate that was completed by the department, please feel free to contact us. And one other point about revenue estimates, if the author is amending a bill at a hearing in a way that will change the revenue estimate, if you could also let us know. The official revenue estimate may be made for the bill as amended by the author.
Ms. Templin, thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Templin, I was looking through just back on the initial parts of the bullet points on the revenue estimates. And you talk about this that there's no credit given for general stimulus to the economy and the assumptions. But yet, further down, you say that behavioral responses are sometimes taken into account. I'm trying to connect them, and maybe wrongly so. You know, sometimes there are some... I guess I'm wondering what your general rule of thumb is regarding the behavioral piece. Maybe that's how I'll ask it.
Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, that is. I don't think there's kind of a black and white rule that the department uses for revenue estimates based on your question. I think, like, as an example, and I think if they're here, they may want to respond, but as an example, like for capital gains, that, you know, there's a lot of dynamic analysis going on in there, and they will reluctantly provide, I think, a static analysis on that sort of an estimate. Whereas for elasticity, I think there are some more different assumptions that can be made where they feel more comfortable in including that in a revenue estimate. But I don't see anyone from the department, but I can check with Paul Wilson, the department director, and try to get a more clarification on the rules on when they are applied for dynamic or static analysis or dynamic analysis and elasticity.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I would like that information. I'm just kind of curious how it's laid out. And I was just even going back to Mr. Michael's presentation with the estate tax. Mm-hmm. He mentioned something about behavioral changes when our tax is not quite conforming to the federal tax and things along those lines. I'm wondering if that would be a behavioral change that would be taken into account on the revenue estimate or not.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Representative Broad, I will get back to you on that question. And I, estate taxes, I think I do remember some revenue estimates with that sort of behavioral changes and assumptions made. But I will get back to you after I talk to the department. The next part of this presentation has to do with fiscal notes, and my colleague Catherine Schill will be covering the rest.
Good afternoon, members. A fiscal note estimates the effects of proposed legislation on state expenditures and non-general fund revenues. That part is really very important. Minnesota Statute Section 3.98 addresses fiscal notes, requiring the head of a state agency, including the Supreme Court, to prepare a fiscal note at the request of the legislature. For the tax committee, a fiscal note is needed only when a bill would do one of two different things. First of all, cause a change in state agency administration. A good example of this would be adding staff to the Department of Revenue if you wanted to enhance compliance audits, something like that. Additional expenditures, changing the form of the tax form for reporting, things like that, where they would actually get in and have administrative changes. The second thing that would require a fiscal note is a cause in a state agency change in revenue that is not collected by the Department of Revenue. And what would that be? That could be a license fee for the medical board. It could be a fishing fee. It could be a number of different things, something that the Department of Revenue does not collect. Unlike the tax committee, most finance committees in the House will use fiscal notes to estimate a bill's fiscal impact for both costs and revenues. When I was with the health committee, for example, I processed a good 180 fiscal notes for the business of that committee. You will not likely see 180 fiscal notes in this particular committee. We rely more heavily on the revenue estimate process that Ms. Templin talked about. However, the tax committee will see certain bills which come before the committee with non-general fund revenue estimates, and they'll be analyzed using a fiscal note. Your fiscal staff will oversee these estimates and seek additional information about them if necessary.
Ms. Schell, can you define for the committee a little further to help new members think about this? Give a few examples of non-tax revenues.
Non-tax revenues could be
that we might see in this committee.
Highway funds, anything having to do with the health care access funds, certain motor vehicle registration fees, things like that. Last budget, I think, and you've got it on the spreadsheet that we gave to you, but I gave it to the page to use for copying. On the page, okay, this is your document. And it has five spreadsheets on the page that on the back of the Word document. You'll see one of the spreadsheets that says non-general fund changes in revenue. It lists healthcare access fund, highway user tax distribution fund, metro area transit fund. So those kinds of things. We use fiscal notes, and at times we will seek for the Department of Revenue to enhance a revenue estimate if they feel comfortable. Many times they do not, especially things for like lottery estimates will turn back to the state agency. So that this is an example of where you would see a fiscal note used for non-general fund revenue estimates.
Thank you.
Okay. Fiscal notes are coordinated and reviewed by the Department of Finance with the input from all relevant state agencies. I won't go into detail. You see these in other committees, but you can have a very simple fiscal note, or you can have a complex fiscal note with reporting from five, six, seven different agencies, depending on the subject matter. And then to obtain a fiscal note, once again, we ask you to contact either Ms. Templin or myself. There's actually a huge database. There's a huge process by which we electronically enter a request. And so if we can help by coordinating that, that would be really very good. One other note on fiscal notes in particular, there's a recent Money Matters that was just posted to the web. And if anybody wants a hard copy, I can give it to you on the fiscal note process. It's a 10-page document done by one of our colleagues, but it's up on the fiscal analysis website if you wanted more information on fiscal notes. With that, I'll turn to local impact notes. A local impact note estimates the effect of proposed legislation or on a rule for local governments. Minnesota Statute Section 3.98739 addresses local impact notes for state-mandated actions in a process that's done separately from the fiscal note process. Local notes are coordinated and reviewed by the Department of Finance with input from local officials. Determining local costs is one of the more difficult analyses to perform, and as such, a local note may take several weeks to complete. I have a note here if anyone wanted an example. Done last session, the local impact note for the eminent domain bill. It was House File 2846, a bill to define and modify eminent the eminent domain process. The request was placed on March 8th, and the note was actually released on April 3rd, 1 month later. Only the chair or ranking minority of the House Tax Committee or the Senate Finance Committee can request a local impact note. The Commissioner of Finance is requested to also inform the bill's author when a local impact note has been requested. And so at times you can get good numbers from this. At times you can't get any good numbers from this. But it, at least from the local note that is released, you can get some pretty valuable information for your decision-making process.
And excuse me, Ms. Shell, and we'll go to the tracking sheets because I can see we're getting tight on time. But
I do
want to tell members, the local, especially returning members, know that these local fiscal impact notes are really frustrating because they take a very long time, and we sometimes have voted on the bills after we get the local fiscal note. So I have expressed that concern. I know it's been a bipartisan concern to the Department of Finance, and I think when we hear from them, along with our House fiscal staff, and I think now I want to add Representative Broad's question on the modeling for behavioral versus static. When they're here, I think we want to ask the Department of Revenue some of those questions and kind of how that all gets coordinated. Because I do think some of these issues get multifaceted, and then when members wait a month, I remember the stadium bill, for example. You know, we all didn't have a local fiscal note. That was very difficult, and it's certainly not the two people sitting up there. But we do want to learn from revenue how these different issues and the one Representative Broad has raised could be better, could be worked out better for this committee.
Back to the spreadsheet analysis. I give up my spreadsheet. we're talking again on the spreadsheet document. For the tax committee in particular, the thing to point out about the spreadsheet is there are two components to it. The first part is the revenue side. Any changes in revenue you will see listed on the spreadsheet. You have a second portion of the document. So the revenue side in your particular case, and we use an example from last biennium to avoid confusion. So this is what was passed by the tax committee 2 years ago. So the first full page front and back is the revenue change summary, and the second page is the expenditure change summary. The last page, once again, a listing of the non-general fund changes. And finally, on the very back, listed as a catalog of budget activities for tax aids and credits. This is something new that your fiscal staff has been working on. This is going to be updated for the February forecast, but it will give you a brief thumbnail sketch of expenditures and proposed estimates from the February forecast for each and every aid and credit expenditure on your sheet. So the first group in the example that you have is the property tax refund component. So this will correlate directly with the spreadsheet, and you'll have the basis in law and a brief thumbnail description. And it's running about 16 pages right now. So those of you who know it well, you know your line items well, this will be old hat. For those of you who don't know a thing about the spreadsheet, you'll at least get a way to track it and understand what's going on.
Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Stiller, Ms. Templin? If not, we're thank you again. We're going to move back to Mr. Michael, I believe. And we have about 20 more minutes, members, and then we will be done with all but the property tax. I know it's long, a lot of orientation, but our tax code is very complex, and we will be dealing in every area of it. So we want members, as all those amendments start coming quickly at the end and all the bills are getting heard, to have the context to think about the tax system in. So I thank you for your patience. And Mr. Michael, are you ready for us?
Madam Chair, I am ready. Basically, what I want to do very briefly is to talk a little bit about the use of the tax system for other than revenue-raising purposes. Obviously, the fundamental purpose of taxes is to raise money to operate government, but as those of you who've been in the tax committee for many years know, I think probably more time is spent on other issues that don't relate strictly to revenue raising. And basically what I want to do is to talk and to provide some context for the way I think that the staff thinks about dealing with these issues, which might be useful to you in your deliberations. And so this is just going to be a short run through of some of the factors to think about when you're evaluating these kinds of provisions. What are the typical non-revenue raising purposes that tax provisions have? Probably the most frequent thing is trying to change market behavior to get people to do things they otherwise would not do. Sometimes the tax system is simply used to deliver government benefits and services as an alternative.
You have a handout right there, Manager.
Excuse me. So. You know, I was wondering the same thing. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Gerhardt. We're going to get the handout. I thought you were getting excited about whether or not the tax system should be used to change market behavior. And that's coming around now. Mr. Michael, thank you for bringing that up, Representative Earhart.
A couple of other uses, non-revenue uses, is to correct market imperfections and to foster economic development. That's probably one of the biggies. So basically what I want to do in 20 minutes or less is to talk, first of all, about the basic tax policy principles that I think most of you who've been around here for any length of time are pretty familiar with, but are the basic rules that are guidelines that we use in evaluating tax provisions, including non-revenue raising provisions. Then to talk a little bit about some of the more types of these provisions. And then finally to talk about some things you might want to think about as you try to evaluate them. Tax policy principles.
Excuse me, Mr. Michael. I apologize, Representative Brott.
I'm sorry, to Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, do you have an easy breakdown of the amount of taxes that are used for revenue-raising purposes versus non-revenue-raising purposes? Is that something you've ever done?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Brott, that's not something that I've sort of ever tried to quantify. I suppose one way to do that would be to take the tax expenditure budget, although there are some problems with the theory under that, and to say, well, let's see how much we raise in explicit revenues and how much we have in tax expenditures, and then sort of try to normalize that. If we had just a revenue neutral rate, what would that be? But I've never gone through that exercise. That would be a very interesting sort of thing to do, because it sort of measures the extent to which the tax system is sort of being used for these ancillary purposes. And there's, you know, to the extent that you accept what we'll talk about in a minute about the neutrality principle, all of those things sort of distort behavior, and if that's bad, you know, then obviously that's a measure of it. If it's, you know, if you're okay with it, then I guess it's not that important. But
Representative Brott.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, I'm glad you would find that interesting. If you ever have a rainy day and would like to do that exercise, I would be interested in the result, because I think it would tell us quite a bit, actually.
Madam Chair, I would agree. But anyway, the basic four principles that I think virtually everybody agrees on, these principles, the art of the business, of course, is the trade-offs you make in trying to achieve them, because you can't achieve them all at the same time. And when you move in one direction, you often have a trade-off in the other direction. But the four basic principles are equity, efficiency or neutrality, simplicity, and revenue adequacy. Equity principle really has two components. The first one is horizontal equity, and that's to say we're going to treat people who are the same. You treat people equally. So if you've got two people with the same income, they should pay the same tax if you've got an income tax, for example. Vertical equity is often probably the more commonly discussed form of equity around this table, and that relates to progressivity, regressivity, the distribution by income class. Efficiency, basically the core of the efficiency principle is sort of premised on the market system, and that's the idea that market allocations really are the best way to allocate scarce resources. And therefore, we want to have taxes affect market behavior as little as possible. Simplicity. Basically, there are a couple of components to simplicity, or three components, I guess, at least. One is the tax should be understandable, transparent. People should know who pays it, where the money goes, and so forth. It should be easy for taxpayers to comply with and easy for the government to administer. Revenue adequacy, obviously the only reason we, or not the only reason, but the primary reason we have taxes is to raise money to fund the government. And it's a choice as to the size of government, and this principle really doesn't say anything about the size of government, but it says that in terms of revenue flows, there are a couple of things that are useful. One, to what extent are the revenues reliable and predictable, or the stability principle? The second principle is elasticity. It's useful if those revenues grow as the economy and the population grows, so that revenues keep pace with the changes in the economy and the size of the population. So those are the four basic principles that that are very useful to use in evaluating both revenue-raising purposes for taxes and non-revenue-raising taxes. Now, to just digress a little bit and talk more about the kinds of non-revenue uses that non-revenue-raising uses that we put the tax system to. The first major category that I noted before is to change market behavior. Just some examples of this. We use the tax system in many ways to try to encourage home ownership. For example, the deductions for mortgage interest and property tax on the income tax. All of the tax benefits that we provide under the property tax for homesteads. Lower class rates, credits, so forth. All of those are designed to change people's behavior from, you know, a neutral choice about the extent they prefer to be a homeowner or a renter, to encourage them to be more in favor of homeownership. A couple of few other things: encourage support for charities, the charitable contribution deduction under the income tax exemptions, and property tax exemptions for some kinds of charitable uses fit into this. Encourage purchasing long-term care insurance. We've got a credit, the long-term care insurance credit, that attempts to do that. Or encourage private education spending. We've got the deduction under the income tax and a credit for many of those spending items for K-12 education. Another big category of non-revenue uses is to deliver government benefits through the tax system. Couple examples of this: providing welfare-like benefits through the Earned Income Credit or the Working Family Credit, Minnesota's version of the Earned Income Credit, education assistance through the K-12, the refundable K-12 education credit. That's just a convenient way of getting money to those parents, typically, that are sending for private education for their children, for hiring tutors and so forth. Providing child care, the refundable dependent care credit. Encouraging construction of low-income housing. We authorize the issuance of tax-exempt bonds and provide preferential property tax treatments for these kinds of developments. Correcting market imperfections. This is something that's not often done, but this is the sort of thing that academic economists like to talk about. And the thing that makes this somewhat unusual is almost all of these other types of non-revenue uses tend to violate this neutrality or efficiency principle because they're changing what otherwise market behavior would occur. In this case, the assumption is there's something wrong with the market. The market prices are not accurately reflecting the real costs or the real benefits. And so the idea with these kinds of tax provisions is to sort of adjust the market so it does reflect that. And the two categories are spillovers. That's a case where someone is doing something that has a general benefit to the public that they can't get a benefit from themselves privately. And a classic case of that is, for example, the research and development credits. It's generally accepted that companies that engage in private research confer a general benefit on the populace generally, then they can't capture by making more money. You know, you advance the research cause, and other businesses and other people benefit from that. And so economists would say, hey, it's appropriate in that case to give a credit to someone like that because you're compensating them for the fact that they're conferring this benefit on the general public. The flip side of that is sometimes private activity imposes external costs. Obviously, the most common example of this is pollution. If somebody dumps something into the river, the people who enjoy the river downstream suffer from that. Now, the person that's dumping it into the river in the old days, before there were pollution rules, there weren't didn't suffer any benefits, and so maybe it was in their interest to do that. And so, again, that might be an appropriate case where you impose a tax to discourage that use so that that person recognizes, gee, I'm causing X dollars of costs on other people, and I really need to take that into account in making my production decisions. Finally, economic development, and this is states all engage in this as a way to attract and encourage businesses to expand in the state. Single sales apportionment is probably the most common one that you've heard about this at the general level. Redevelop blighted sites, for example, by using tax increment financing. Or maybe to help a specific industry, like the bioscience zones, or to help encourage businesses to locate in depressed areas. I mean, that's sort of what Job Z was mainly about.
Mr. Michael, excuse me,
Representative
Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, you hit on exactly what I was going to ask you a question about, thinking of biotech zones and the Job Z's. What, and this is maybe a two-part question, what of any data have you seen? We've talked about it here many times about how states compete with other states. You know, thinking of the biotech, I think California's put $1 billion in almost every other year. We put in a couple hundred million here or there. How is that disparity kind of come out in the wash? And then what have you seen as a rise of these kind of these bidding wars between states, one state versus another? How have these bidding wars escalated over time? Is this something that just happens, or over the last maybe decade or so have we seen an increase?
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, I don't know that I've seen anything that sort of academics or researchers have done that have sort of analyzed really that question about is there a rise in the level of this activity. And there's a big debate, which I'll get into a little bit later, about whether these measures are effective or not. And of course, economists in trying to measure effectiveness have sort of limits as to the data and the sophistication of their measurement techniques. So the fact that a lot of studies don't find any effect doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't an effect. It just may mean that they're not successful at measuring it. But in any case, I think this kind of behavior is just expected behavior because the states are, in many ways, with a number of sort of open economies, they're really in competition with each other. And just like you would expect businesses that are trying to convince, people to eat at their restaurant rather at somebody else's restaurant, that's exactly the same kind of behavior that states engage in, and it's rational behavior, and it's what you would expect. And as information gets better, you would expect there to be more of it, because people like you folks know more about what the other states are doing and whether or not they're being effective, so it's the natural thing to do is how can we sort of adjust our policies to compete with them, So it's, I don't know, in some ways that might be discouraging, but I think that's sort of the reality. The last thing I'd sort of like to do is to run through just very quickly some of the factors that I think might be useful to think about when you're confronted with these kinds of proposals to use the tax system for purposes other than just raising revenues for the government. Just to go back to the sort of the academic thing, this business about correcting market imperfections, you know, that you'll get the academic, the professors will come up and tell you, hey, that's good to do that. One of the problems are, of course, that it's probably challenging in the real world to actually measure the size of those benefits and those externalities that are being imposed or conferred. And so it's tough to actually set the tax rate, and so there's a risk there. Second, there's complexity and difficulty to administer, and so getting back to our tax principles, the sort of simplicity, ease of administration may argue against this. Another good argument for doing it, in some cases, it may be the most, using the tax system may be the most effective way, cheapest way, to deliver some government benefits. And so those of us who are purists and say, gee, let's only use the tax system to raise revenues, may have to give in and say, well, this is a case where this is the best way for the government to actually deliver these benefits, because we're panning out, you know, a small amount of money to a lot of people. And if we did it through the welfare system, for example, there may be stigmas that would cause some people to not participate and so on. So those can be some factors. In thinking about whether some of these provisions are effective in changing market behavior, it's crucial always to think about how people behave at the margin, because that's where it really makes a difference. How does it affect the prices that they're going to encounter? Now, obviously, the best thing we could have is if there were studies that showed us, yeah, if we did this, this is the elasticity, and if we offered this sort of incentive, people will respond and do that. The problem is there's very few of those studies around, and so oftentimes you're going to have to act on intuition and theory and common sense. One of the problems with any of these incentives, it rewards a lot of people for doing something that they were going to do anyway. And to the extent that we're trying to be cost-effective about the way we use our money, that obviously diminishes the return on what we're spending. On the other hand, it's somewhat difficult to say, gee, we knew you were going to do this anyway, and we can somehow figure that out, and so we're going to deny you the benefit. And so oftentimes fairness says you have to give it to everybody. Some tax incentives are designed to try to eliminate that, for example, the R&D credit. And what happens is you get really complex and difficult to administer provisions. Another factor to keep in mind is there are federal tax effects to these incentives. To the extent that you're reducing a tax that's deductible in computing federal tax, in essence, the government's going to end up taxing that benefit that you're giving. And that's going to dilute the benefit to the taxpayer, because they get a smaller federal tax deduction, or they have to pay tax on what they got. And so, again, that just makes it more expensive for the state to do it. The slide sort of shows what some of the percentage changes could be. If you give a corporation a dollar, that's going to raise their federal tax by 35 cents. So it's only going to change when they decide about a behavioral change. They're going to say, well, you've given me a 65-cent benefit, not a dollar benefit. Income distribution considerations. One of the things about using the tax system, particularly the income tax benefit, is there's this upside-down income effect. So in other words, if you give a tax deduction to somebody, the person that's in the top tax bracket gets a more valuable benefit than the person in the low tax bracket. And now if we were going to do a direct spending program like that, I don't think anybody would ever think of doing that. You're going to, you know, okay, you've got higher income, we'll give you a bigger benefit, you have lower income. Now, the way you can address that is by using a credit instead that gives a flat rate to everybody, the same dollar amount. On the other hand, you have to keep in mind some people don't pay tax, and so if you don't make it refundable, they won't get a benefit. And so if you want to give them an incentive, the credit needs to be refundable. Tax administration, I think this is all pretty obvious, and since I'm obviously all of these provisions make it tougher to administer the tax system and just put more stress on the system. Constitutional considerations, this is Representative Mullery talked about this before, the federal Constitution limits our ability to design some incentives, and so that becomes a factor. And here's one of those instances where using direct spending is easier than using the tax system, and they've got two examples there. One is the ethanol subsidies. We started out with the ethanol program as a tax credit program, and the court struck it down because it discriminated against interstate commerce. Archer Daniel Midland sued the state and said, hey, you can't deny us this tax credit for our Illinois production. And the legislature, when it was faced with that, said, gee, we really don't want to start giving tax credits to plants in Illinois. And so the solution to that was they converted it to a direct spending program. And there are different rules, the constitutional restrictions on direct spending programs. There's a lot more leeway for states. And so rather than giving a, you know, a 20-cent a gallon or a 10-cent a gallon tax credit to an ethanol producer, we just have the Department of Agriculture write them a check, and that's constitutional and that works. That's a, with Minnesota's 529 college savings plan, there were some of the same considerations involved that provided a matching grant rather than a tax deduction to the contributors. Another thing to think about, and that just the segue from that is, would it work better? Would it be more cost effective, or would you do a better job of delivering the benefits with a direct spending program? Sometimes this might be the case if you've got a small number of recipients. The state already has a relationship with who's ever involved so that you can easily transfer the money or provide the benefits to them. Are some of the recipients outside of the tax system, for example, people that don't make enough money to pay tax or nonprofits, etc.? Generally, permanency is another factor. Tax expenditures tend to go on unless the legislature changes them. Direct spending programs, by contrast, have to be reappropriated regularly. And so for the recipients of the programs, they'd obviously much rather have a permanent provision that just continues on rather than come back to the legislature every 2 years and fight the budget process for their appropriation.
Hey, Mr. Weichel, I'm going to stop you there. I think we're just not going to be able to do this last piece, which I think is really important, and so we'll just start with that, the economic development tax provisions, when we meet tomorrow. So with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you, Mr. Weichel.